Good evening and welcome behind the news for March 4, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got two interviews lined up for tonight. First, an interview recorded earlier this week with Corey Robin, who is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College, about the thinking of the people around Bush, the neocons, and their worldview, which is extremely martial. And they don't like peace and prosperity. They like war and discipline, and we'll hear more from Corey Robin, who's got an essay on that topic in the current issue of the Boston Review. And then around the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Laura Flanders, who will be joining us in the studio. I think not a strange voice in these airwaves. Laura will be talking about her new book, Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, just out from Verso, about rather important women around George Bush. Starting with Condoleezza Rice and Karen Hughes and even Laura, too. Laura Bush, that is, not Laura Flanders. Before we get to the interviews, a few words about the economic headlines, as we do at the top of the show. As usual, we'll start with this morning's release of the weekly count of new claims for unemployment insurance, which is a very sensitive and timely indicator of what's going on in the job market. This covers last week, and it's released, you know, less than a week after the end of the week. So it's very timely and also a very good measure of the strength of the job market. It had been falling for much of last year, started falling in the spring and fell through the end of the year, and has sort of stalled out over the last several weeks. It did fall 7,000. To 345,000 for the week ending February 28. And for the week before, that's a little slower reporting, but the number of people continuing to draw unemployment benefits was steady at about 3.1 million. And these numbers are considerably improved from a year ago, but they could be better. And they are showing a job market that is getting better, but slowly. And it does seem that, as I've been reporting here for weeks, the pace of layoffs has been slowing, but the pace of hiring doesn't seem to be picking up. Tomorrow morning, we'll bring the release of the monthly jobs report, that is, the count of the number of people employed, the number of people unemployed, and that will be, of course, data for February, and expecting modest growth in employment, again, a continuation of the modest improving trend, but still a very, very subpar kind of recovery in the U.S. job market, even though a lot of the headline kinds of economic statistics are doing well, it's not really trickling down to people looking for work. And also we're seeing very weak increases in wages, so it'll be very interesting to see if that trend has continued in February. The hourly wage less inflation had been rising for most of the 90s into the early 2000s, and hit a wall about a year ago and is now stagnant again, very much like it was in the 80s and early 90s. So we'll see if this is just a temporary cyclical thing or the return of a trend that prevailed for 20, 25 years throughout the 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s. The weakness in the job market is taking its toll on consumer attitudes. The weekly poll of consumers by ABC News and Money Magazine fell. Its measure of consumer comfort, as they call it, fell from minus 13 the week ending February 22nd to minus 16 last week. That's the worst reading we've seen since November. It had been improving from November into early January, but around the middle of January, a lot of these confidence measures seem to start heading south. And that, I think, has something to do with George Bush's political troubles. And, of course, the weakness in the job market is taking its toll on consumer attitudes. It's very strange, though, that people with jobs or who feel secure in their jobs have been spending quite aggressively. They don't seem to be tightening belts in anticipation of tougher times or just being prudent. They do. They've been spending aggressively and borrowing quite aggressively. But if you don't have a job, it's quite difficult to find one. And most people in polls describe this as a tough job market. Jobs are not plentiful. Jobs are hard to get. But those that are well off or feel comfortable or safe are doing reasonably well. And also, Gallup reported earlier this week a fairly large gap between the attitudes of men and women towards the job market. with men reporting significantly more optimistic attitudes than women. And that, I think, also ripples through the political numbers with the current administration much more popular with men than women. And also, a lot of research shows that men are much more self-confident than women and more likely to take risks, sometimes to their own detriment, than women. So that kind of self-confidence may not actually serve men well, but it is one of the features of the gender, it seems. Also reported this morning, factory orders, new factory orders in January fell 0.5%, a little worse than people expected because of plunging orders for cars and airplanes. And it does, however, seem that spending on capital goods, that is, planted equipment by businesses, if you strip out aircraft, which is a very volatile series, that's been improving for the last couple of months. So that is absolutely essential for a better better economic recovery. So there are some signs that that's happening, but it's not anywhere near boom levels yet either. So the U.S. economy stumbling into recovery, but hardly thriving at this point. And that's the story. It's been for months now. The Institute for Supply Management, which does polls of its members every month, these are the people, purchasing managers, people who buy things for corporations and are very sensitive to the state of business. The poll of manufacturing purchasing managers remained above the 50 level, well above the 50 level. When it's above 50, the economy is expanding. When it's below 50, the economy is contracting. It was at 61 in February, down from almost 64 in January. So a little decline, but still a pretty firm number. And it also, its component on employment also remaining above 50. So some signs of an improving employment outlook. In services, also very similar pattern. Number fell from January, but still well above 50 at 61, and also the employment numbers above 50 also. So both of those are suggesting improvement in hiring, but they have been saying this for months and it hasn't come to pass. So they're teasing us. We'll see if reality actually catches up to these predictions, but so far it hasn't yet. Some news from abroad, GDP, gross domestic product, the value of goods and services for the Eurozone, that is the 12 countries in Western Europe that constitute the euro currency. Their GDP was up 0.6% in the fourth quarter of last year. Quite a weak performance, although better than the two previous quarters when it was barely up at all. It does seem that the strong value of the euro in the foreign exchange markets has been holding back exports, and this is one of the stories in the global economy these days. The dollar has been falling, but mainly against the euro. The Asian currencies, where the U.S. has been running its largest trade deficit, those currencies have been pretty tightly tied to the dollar, and so it does seem that the euro is taking the brunt of the adjustment, much to the detriment of the European economy. Very difficult to get exports in this kind of environment. Within the Eurozone, France and Spain were doing quite well. The Dutch economy doing a bit better, and Germany and Italy were turned in very disappointing performances. Reuters does a survey of purchasing managers in the Eurozone, very much like our own Institute for Supply Management survey. It's also above 50, but not anywhere near as much as it is here. The manufacturing index at 53, the services index at 56. So both indicating expansion, but in both cases also their employment components are below 50, suggesting that employment is flat or contracting in both manufacturing and services in Western Europe. But despite that economic weakness, the European Central Bank refuses to loosen. They keep interest rates much higher than they should be if they wanted an economic recovery. But Europe's central bank is run by a bunch of sadomonetarists who love constriction and discipline, and they just refuse to yield. Employment in Germany not doing very well. I reported the other day that unemployment rate rose from 10.2 to 10.3%, and The jobless, the increase in the number of jobless actually exceeded what most economists were expecting, and the German economy just not doing very well and not being able to recover. And finally, some news from elsewhere in this hemisphere. Canada's economy has been quite strong lately. Canada, as I've mentioned a couple of times, I believe, actually produced more jobs at the end of last year than the United States did, even though its economy is a tenth our size. It actually produced more jobs. And its growth rate, almost 4%, quite a strong performance from Canada, partly because of strength in the recovery in the U.S., which is boosting Canadian exports, but also investment expanded strongly, and consumption doing pretty well, too. So the Canadian economy, which started the year on a fairly weak note, went out on a much stronger note. Things are not doing quite so well in our southern neighbor, Mexico. Their growth was reported the other week at about 2%. Not a great number for an economy with a country with a very rapidly expanding population and one that needs to employ lots of people all the time. They need much stronger growth rates than that, although 2% was an improvement over the middle of the year. It's still not enough. And the labor markets in Mexico just not doing too well. Employment at the last year down about 4%, very bad performance, even though the economy was turning in positive numbers. Better news, however, from Brazil, where it does seem that that recession that took hold shortly after Lula took office as president of Brazil, that does seem to be shaken off, and the Brazilian economy about flat at the end of last year, and much of an improvement, quite a bit of improvement from the middle of the year when it was declining at a fairly rapid rate. So some signs of recovery in Brazil. And next week I'm going to try to get someone to talk about the political economy of Haiti. We've heard a lot about the political violence in Haiti, but I really want to do some kind of extended examination of just why the country is so poor. We're not hearing very much of those kinds of long-term considerations, and I think didn't have time to get someone together for this week, but next week I'll try to do that because it's, I think, one of the great uncovered stories. We're getting acres of news about Haiti, but not much about the decades of abuse by the United States and systematic exploitation and creation of misery that created the modern political economy of Haiti. So we'll take a look at that next week. And now let's turn to an interview we recorded yesterday with Corey Robin, who teaches politics at Brooklyn College. He's got a piece called Endgame, Conservatives After the Cold War, in the current issue of the Boston Review, which you can find on the web at bostonreview, all one word, .net, bostonreview.net. Corey Robin, and this is the author of the piece. And it will also appear in a collection that will be out in a couple of months from the New Press called Cold War Triumphalism, edited by Ellen Schrecker. So let's listen to Corey Robin.
Welcome to WBAI, Corey. Apparently, a lot of the neocons around Bush were dissatisfied with the peace and prosperity of the 90s. To me, the only problem with the peace and prosperity of the 90s was that there wasn't enough of it to go around. But what's the problem with peace and prosperity in their eyes?
Well, for them, I think the neocons are, I would describe them as basically romantics who prize war and militarism as ends unto themselves. These are people who believe that war and militarism offer opportunities for a kind of heroic struggle against the deadening effects of modernity, and peace and prosperity in their minds in the 90s with Clinton, you know, which Clinton spearheaded, really represented a softening of mores domestically in the United States. I mean, if you read carefully, actually you don't even have to read that carefully, through the work of people like Robert Kaplan, David Brooks, you'll find that they really felt that the peace and prosperity of the 90s really corrupted American morals. It made us softer, it made us less heroic, it made us less willing to take on the sort of epic struggles like the Cold War, the fight against the Nazis. And that's to them what the sort of culture of Clintonism and the culture of the free market really represented.
You're not just jumping to conclusions. There's plenty of textual evidence which you cite. Could you give us some examples of the kinds of things that they've been saying?
Yeah. If you read, someone like David Brooks, This is how he describes the 90s, and this he wrote after 9/11. He said, during the 90s, we renovated our kitchens, we refurbished our home entertainment systems, we invested in patio furniture, jacuzzis, and gas grills. Francis Fukuyama talked about what he calls the self-indulgent behavior of the 90s and the sort of a preoccupation with our own petty affairs. David Brooks, again, after 9/11, said that, what was so wonderful about 9/11 in his mind was that today, suddenly, he said, commercial life seems less important than public life. When life or death fighting is going on, it's hard to think of Bill Gates or Jack Welch as particularly heroic. In other words, all the sort of cultural icons of the 90s, and they go through these sort of capitalist icons like Jack Welch and Bill Gates, and also the sort of the Seinfeld and the kind of more particular culture of television and so forth. In their minds, they think represents this sort of softening that I was talking about, the softening of mores.
This brings back what we talked about when you were on the show a couple of years ago. People like Bill Buckley and Irving Kristol were somewhat dissatisfied with conservative ideology as being so oriented towards the free market and looking for something a bit more heroic. How does that fit in?
Well, in fact, this was partially what I went back to in this article. I mean, if you look back at some of those quotes, I mean, this is what Buckley said. He said, the trouble with the emphasis on conservatism on the market is that it becomes rather boring. You hear it once, you master the idea. The notion of devoting your life to it is horrifying, if only because it's so repetitious. It's like sex. And this was a big theme that both Bill Buckley and Irving Kristol, when I interviewed them back in 2000, before the 2000 presidential race, both of them emphasized that there's something wrong with capitalist democracies. And Kristol in particular was quite interesting on this. He was very clear on the matter that the problem with capitalist democracies is that they can't really be the imperial power that he would like them to be. He said to me that, you know, the problem with capitalist democracies like ours is that, you know, we're so influenced by business culture and business modes of thinking that we have no political imagination. And then he went on to say that that was really too bad, that the United States really could be a wonderful empire in the world, and in particular he pointed out Africa, but, you know, with this culture of the free market so pervasive, it was almost impossible, he thought, that we could ever aspire to something like that. And he pointed out to me, I remember this in particular, the debate at the time, remember, in the Republican Party about the drug prescription benefit for elderly people. And he said, I just can't believe that the Republican Party is arguing over something like this. He said, you know, who gives a damn about it? I think it's disgusting that this is what we're arguing about. And then he concluded in this great flourish, he said, this isn't Athens, it's not Rome, it's not anything. So this was a theme for these guys throughout the 90s, and it came as something as a surprise to me, because we always associate the Republican Party and the conservative movement with this sort of unalloyed endorsement of the free market, and yet here, these were people who were really complaining about it, and not because it promotes disorder or sort of social dislocation, which is an old conservative theme and not that surprising, but much more because it was really reducing the sort of martial spirit and the imperial valor that they had hoped the United States would assume in the wake of the Cold War.
Well, it's funny, a lot of traditional analysts of imperialism, people coming out of the Marxist tradition, but not just those, would say that the whole point of empire is ultimately economic, to increase economic returns, to make money in the dominated regions. This seems like a very non-economic conception of empire.
Well, there certainly is a very non-economic conception of empire, and I should be careful here because I'm not really making an argument about what is the American empire actually up to today, and I'm not trying to get into a dispute about whether or not it's economically or driven or not. But in the neocons' conception, it's very clear that in their eyes, empire is actually relief or a release from the constraints of the market, and that's why it's so appealing. And there's actually an old tradition of analysis that has sort of pointed, if you go back to Hannah Arendt's book in her section on imperialism, that's exactly how she understood figures like Cecil Rhodes and sort of the, you know, the apex of British and French and German imperialism, really saw these characters, these imperial characters, as seeking a release from the constraints of bourgeois civilization, particularly bourgeois, the culture of the market. So this is actually there's some precedent for it here. And it's very clear, in at least how they think of themselves and how they think of the imperial project, that it is a way of escaping from what capitalism is all about. Now, whether or not that's actually true in practice, I mean, I, I, I don't really touch that. I leave that to other people because, you know, it's not something I've really thought as much about. But at least in terms of the ideology, that seems quite clear to me.
And a lot of this love of heroism and martial discipline evokes, you know, I hate to bring in the heavy artillery, but it does seem vaguely fascist in its undertone.
Well, there is that element to it, and I mean, I sort of hesitate, like you, to bring in that as well. But there's certainly, there's certainly some element of that kind of, you know, sort of revanchist rhetoric that you see in there. Although what's interesting with these guys, what they talk about is, you know, what they're going out doing is in terms of the sort of militarism abroad, is to actually create sort of bourgeois societies, to create societies of law and order and stability and so forth. So it's the end goal of what they're talking about is certainly, at least in terms of their conception, not at all fascistic. But what it seems to me, what's so interesting about that is that though they talk about that as the end, they really have very little interest in that as the end. It's really the means to the end that seems to sort of awaken their enthusiasm, because when they actually achieve that end, when they find that they get a culture where the free market is permanently instantiated, you know, they have nothing but sort of, you know, for at best melancholy, to at worst total contempt. So there's a strange sort of irony there about that. But yeah, I think the sort of valorization of struggle does have some pretty disturbing lineages and linkages.
But on the other hand, the culture of comfort lingers. It does seem that they're not willing to demand too much in the way of sacrificing the American population, or at least from their friends. You almost suspect that they're looking for an excuse to repress their enemies. But they're not. They're still giving tax cuts to rich people. They don't want to restrict access to SUVs or do any of those sorts of things. So, how comprehensive and ambitious is this vision, really?
Well, that's one of the things I take up in the article in the second half, is to actually deal exactly with that question. They hate the culture of the market, but they are not really willing at all to confront the institutions and reality of the market. And as you bring up the SUV, I take that up. I mean, when the debate about reducing, coming up with higher fuel efficiency standards came up after 9/11, and the pitch was made from the Democratic side, and even from some Republican supporters like John McCain, that this would actually be the patriotic thing to do to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, everybody piled on them, and then you finally found someone like John McCain actually turning around and saying, yeah, it would be really a horrible thing to do to ask some, you know, soccer mom to reduce, you know, not to drive her SUV. So you're absolutely right. They are not. This is why I think this vision is ultimately quite hollow and is probably doomed to failure. Is that they do not want to make the kinds of genuine sacrifices that would be required to sort of make this a genuinely imperial project. And it's partially, I think, what explains, you know, the sort of situation that we're in now in Iraq, where, you know, just what it amazes me is just how profoundly disinterested these people actually apparently were before the war, for the kind of the outcome of the war and the planning of it. And I think they like the ideology of the whole thing, but the reality of it, they're just completely disinterested in.
I'm speaking with Corey Robin, assistant professor of political science at Brooklyn College and author of a piece in the current issue of the Boston Review called Endgame, Conservatives After the Cold War.
And when it comes to choosing targets, it looks like they prefer weak ones. Almost the very fact that the war occurred suggests that the Bush administration knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Their fear of taking on North Korea is further evidence of that. They'll move in Haiti, where opposition is very, very weak, but they really don't want too much in the way of actual military conflict, unless it's a walkover.
Well, it's interesting. I think there's actually a bit of conflict within them about this. If you read David Halberstam's book on, you know, Peace in Time of War, he's actually has quite good evidence about the sort of ambivalence about the first Persian Gulf War, where you know, they really saw this as the opportunity to end the Vietnam syndrome. And it's very clear in their rhetoric, and you can see it again in someone like Bill Kristol today in the Weekly Standard, that if there are not casualties, we have not really whipped the Vietnam syndrome. So on the one hand, I think actually a part of them really does want there to be strong opposition, because if it's just a walkover, you still have the same problem hanging over you, which is the Vietnam syndrome. But on the other hand, I think it's within the military itself, and I think this is, again, where Halberstam is quite good on this, is where the Vietnam syndrome is the strongest and the most resistance. And so I think this is where the neocons come up against their own constituencies, that they'll never be able to get the military to take on a battle where there will really be a significant opposition, although that seems to be inadvertently what we found ourselves in Iraq right now.
Yeah, well, Ivo Dalder and James Lindsay make a distinction between assertive nationalists like Bush, who are fundamentally pragmatic, and the real romantic imperialists of the neocon sort that you're talking about. So, you know, it looks like the Bush administration would like to get out of Iraq because for practical electoral reasons. So
mm-hmm.
How are they going to? How severe is this contradiction, do you think?
Well, I think it's. I mean, I think it's there. I think. I'm never quite. What Bush's actual own political profile is, I have to say, I found something of a mystery, and I think I find him to be a bit of a cipher, and I can't figure him out. But within the administration, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there is a very strong sort of political calculus to get out of Iraq, and I mean, I see Karl Rove as pretty much the person there that's driving that. And I think that does put severe constraints on what the neocons can do. And you see this, and the neocons are quite, you know, well aware of this. I mean, every time something starts going bad in Iraq where we look like we're pulling back, where the United States looks like it's pulling back, you'll see things coming out of the Weekly Standard from Crystal or one of the other guys, you know, really whipping up the base saying, you know, we're bailing out and we're not doing what we should be doing. So I think they realize that they're sort of in a race against time, and it ultimately does suggest a very, very deep fissure within the Republican Party that I think in the end will probably be its undoing. I mean, not necessarily in this election, but certainly within the next decade or so.
Towards the end of your piece, you bring up something somewhat speculative, as you explicitly say, but you wonder if we're witnessing the decomposition of the American ruling class, and certainly the contrast between this gang and, you know, say, the gang around Acheson in the late 40s, early 50s, who really designed the modern world system. It's a pretty stark contrast. So what do you mean by this decomposition of our ruling class?
Well, it's precisely what you just brought up. You know, when you think about, you know, the proverbial wise men of the Cold War, people like Dean Acheson, the Dulles brothers, Averell Harriman, what they really represent is the sort of fusion of the worlds of business and politics. A lot of them came out of, Wall Street, or, you know, banks or legal firms connected with Wall Street, and had a real vision of the state, a kind of passion about the state, as the sort of arranger of the world, certainly of the national economy coming out of the New Deal experience, and then ultimately of the global economy. And what I've been sort of surprised by is that again, it is very speculative, and I do want to stress that, but if you look at, you know, the sort of different sectors of sort of the capitalist corporate elite today, is how politically autistic they are and how completely disinterested they seem to be in affairs of state, which is not to say that they don't want tax cuts and things like that. I mean, they're very aggressive in sort of securing their own interests. But they haven't really created – I mean, the closest person to sort of the Dean Achesons would be someone like Robert Rubin, but of course he was in the Treasury Department. He wasn't the Secretary of State. But, you know, the real sort of disinterest in what the state is doing in terms of managing world affairs, so you have that on the one hand, and I think I quote something from Thomas Friedman from his book, The Olive and the Lexus Tree. He interviews this guy from Silicon Valley, and one of the Silicon Valley execs, and he says, you know, how often do you talk about Iraq or Russia or the foreign wars? And this guy says to Friedman, and this is before the 2000, he says, well, not more than once a year. We don't even care about Washington. Money is extracted by Silicon Valley and then wasted by Washington. I want to talk about people who create wealth and jobs. I don't want to talk about unhealthy and unproductive people. If I don't care about the wealth destroyers in my own country, why should I care about the wealth destroyers in another country? So it's sort of a kind of, like I say, a level of political autism. On the one hand, and then on the other hand, that's the capitalist ruling class. On the other hand, you have these people like Wolfowitz and Pearl and the Crystals, the Kagans, and so forth, who really have very little contact with the business community. I mean, I know some, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about Pearl and so forth, but he doesn't, that's not the world that he comes out of. These people come out of the world of ideas. They come out of think tanks. They come out of government. They come out of the academy or journalism. And there seems to be a kind of disconnect between these two worlds, and it does make you wonder, you know, who's in charge of the store? It seems to me that the sort of capitalist class has kind of given them given them the run of the farm to do what they want, so long as they don't really intrude on too many things at home. And that's where I sort of start getting, you know, where the level of concern I think is the greatest. It's just we seem to be really heading to some kind of apocalyptic endgame, which is the title of the article, where it seems like, you know, nobody's really in charge and nobody is going to step in and, you know, pull back from the apocalypse, because you've got these neocons who kind of are bracing for the apocalypse. And then you've got the sort of capitalist ruling class who seems to be not really a ruling class in that sense, that traditional sense anymore. And you wonder where the sources are that's actually going to put the brakes on this whole thing. I mean, during the run-up to the Iraq war, you kept wondering, you know, where are the sort of wise men who are supposed to step in and just kind of tap the president? I mean, not to be sort of too sentimental about this. Obviously, we've had our share of misbegotten adventures in the past, but you know, the level of lunacy and sort of surreal qualities to the debate, and that nobody could step in and put a stop to it, I think does, you know, especially from sort of the sectors of the business elite, really makes you wonder what's actually going on here, and that there might actually be a fundamental divide between the political ruling class and the economic ruling class, and again suggesting the ultimate sort of fissure, I think, of the Republican Party over time.
So when people like David Harvey suggest that the whole reason for the Iraq adventure is some kind of compensation for American economic decline, you're skeptical.
Again, I mean, I don't like to get too much into the realities of it, but I have to say I am sort of skeptical about it. It's hard for me to actually see what economic benefits come from this whole thing at all. And this is, of course, purely journalistic and anecdotal, but so much of the evidence suggests that most people within sort of corporate ruling circles were against the war in Iraq. Even people within the oil industry were actually, you know, if you read some of the sort of journalistic reports, were against this war. So, you know, it's hard for me to see actually that this is actually in some ways a kind of a reversal of economic decline. And as you yourself have pointed out, I think quite rightly, I mean, the level of economic thinking among this clique is so minimal. I mean, if you, like you always do, and I think correctly, compare the sort of Treasury secretaries we've seen here in the Bush administration versus the two in the Clinton administration, it's like night and day.
And that was Corey Robin, who is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and author of a piece in the current issue of the Boston Review, which you can find on the web at bostonreview, all one word, .net. It's called Endgame, Conservatives After the Cold War, and it will also appear in a collection coming out from the New Press in June, edited by Ellen Schrecker, called Cold War Triumphalism, The Politics of American History After the Fall of Communism. And as Corey said, people in the oil industry weren't even really behind the Iraq War. And on this program, the chief economist of PFC, which used to be known as the Petroleum Finance Corporation, an energy consultancy based in Washington, said exactly that, that the senior executives of the oil industry that he'd been talking to were not behind the Iraq War either. So certainly complicates a lot of our understandings of what that war is all about, but that is indeed what it seems to be the case. This is WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, program behind the news, and we'll be back with Laura Flanders in a moment, just after this word from the Gang of Four.
Thank you.
And that word from the Gang of Four, outside the trains don't run on time, which is exploring the links between patriarchy at home and discipline in the political sphere, and sort of an appropriate linchpin between the Corey Robbins section of the show and the Laura Flanders section of the show. Welcome to the studio, Laura.
Thanks, Doug. You're such a man of the segue there.
Well, I try. The usual feel you get about the Bush administration is a very macho thing. You know, there's W himself with his forced Texas strut. There's Rummy the wrestler and Dick Cheney with his tough guy sneer.
First name.
Indeed. But you've got a book about the women around George Bush. Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, just out from Verso. Why a book about Bush's women?
Well, you know, I mean, apart from anything else, I believe in evening the score, and I think these women have been given a short shrift and an easy ride in the media. If the Bush administration had contested, if they'd run for the presidency with just the Dicks and the Georges and the Rummies on hand, they would never have, insofar as they did, win. What they did in 2000 and what they're going to do again this year is to try to kind of leaven the macho picture that you've just laid out with the women who they brought into the cabinet early on. And if you remember in 2000, there was a slogan around the Republican convention, W stands for women. And part of the language of the campaign then was that this is the new, kinder, gentler Republican Party. This is the Republican Party that embraces women and people of color. And perhaps you remember the convention stage was referred to as a kind of minstrel show where they brought on every African-American Republican activist you've ever heard of and a few of their friends and relations.
Chaka Khan was there too.
Chaka Khan performed, and they beamed in a gospel choir from Georgia, I think it was. They were very clear then, as they are now, that anybody winning a presidency in this country needs to get a good proportion of the women's vote. The women's vote isn't a homogenous thing, and there are lots of divides, but there is no swing voting bloc larger than suburban women. Moderate female voters are the largest swing voter bloc out there and the largest one within the Republican Party's grasp. And you probably remember that the Republican Party has had what they call a women problem for about 25 years. Since
really started
Reagan,
with Reagan, 1980. Yeah.
That ever since, women have been way more likely to support a Democrat for president than a Republican. Bush is trying to sort of roll that back. There was still a huge gender gap against Gore. Gore won the women's vote, so-called, by 10 points. And looking towards 2004, again, they are looking at a very polarized country. Their chances of getting moderate voters are slim. But we're going to see more of these women because Condoleezza Rice, Elaine Chao, the Labor Secretary, Anne Veneman, the Agriculture Secretary, Gail Norton, the Secretary of Interior, and First Lady Laura Bush are deployed, they're already deployed in the political arguments and in the campaign to try to put a different face on the administration, and to some extent they succeed.
But among the pundit class now, the word is that soccer moms are out and NASCAR dads are in. So what's going on with that?
Well, you never quite give up. I think you never quite give up. And I don't think we've seen, as you were mentioning earlier, you know, women are the most pessimistic about the state of the economy. And who better to talk to them and give it your best shot in terms of getting their votes than a woman, Elaine Chao, who's the Labor Secretary, who says that her own story is of being an immigrant from China who arrived at age 8, not speaking a word of English, and has been able to rise to the top of American society, that American society offers opportunity for anybody who is looking for it, falling in with Bush's line that we want to give a job to everybody who wants a job, so if you don't have one, you must not want one or be effectively looking for one. She's very good at casting that line, putting that line out there, and the media have been so lax in actually looking at who these people are that they can get away with it. You know, I think that, you know, we've seen, I think Howard Dean was right. I think that there is an effort to manipulate the working class, the white working class, their sort of social fears about people of color and immigrants and queers and feminists. So they forget who their friends are and what side they're on and what their actual economic interests are. So, too, I think there's been an effort to kind of snow moderate voters with this sort of multi-culti display, as if integrating the halls of power in the 21st century United States is in of itself some kind of sign of enlightened social policy. There isn't the policy, but there are the people. And what this book tries to do is look behind the kind of rosy personal picture to the politics. The Bush administration's been giving us identity politics, all identity, no politics. Who are these people? Elaine Chao, her father was a shipping magnate with close relations to Jiang Zemin of China. Her experience may have been learning English and good for the public school system in Queens that taught her English in a very short amount of time. But then it was growing up in a leafy suburb where there was a half-circle driveway that she helped to macadam with her dad. She had to petition her father to be allowed to work during the summers. Not exactly the stereotype that comes to mind of Chinese immigrant families. And then she went to Mount Holyoke, where she took a golf class. I spoke to somebody who took golf with her. I mean, fair enough, she has her history, but don't tell us that she is the paragon of how immigrants can make good. Her story is specific to her. It's not the general truth.
Well, compared to W, though, she had a hard rise to the top. Let's talk maybe about the most powerful and important woman in the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice. Where'd she come from?
Well, she's another one, you know, who tells her own personal story at the slightest excuse. And people may remember at the Republican convention, what we learned was that her father was the first Republican she ever knew. John W. Rice was a Republican. And she said he registered Republican in segregated Birmingham, Alabama, when the Democrats wouldn't let him register. Again, fair enough. That's his experience. But his story isn't quite as simple as she would lead you to believe. Listen to her and her rhetoric, and her family were middle-class blacks who rose without any help from anybody, no need of help from the state. He didn't believe that. He supported Dr. King's movement against segregation in Alabama. He was the first to administer Head Start in that state. He then became the dean of Stillman College, a black college in the South, and then became dean of student affairs at Denver University in Colorado, where he was very involved in campus activities around the Vietnam War. He initiated a program called the Black Experience in America that brought to Denver University, a private, predominantly white university in a largely African-American town, or a town with a sizable African-American population.
And Chip Brulé took a class with him?
That's how I found this out. Chip Brulé from the Political Research Associates, one of the premier progressive left-wing opposition research people in this country, a treasure of the left. He took a class from Dean Rice, and the class that he took was this seminar series that Dean Rice started called The Black Experience, which brought... wait till you hear the list. Brought Fannie Lou Hamer, Andrew Young, Louis Farrakhan, Margaret Burnham, Angela Davis's lawyer, to campus. Chip got me, Chip, who conveniently was the editor of the campus paper, the Denver Clarion, he got me the transcripts of Dean Rice's addresses to the public, to the campus protests around the killings in Kent State and Jackson State, the police shootings of Vietnam War protesters and civil rights activists. Dean Rice looked out to the crowd and said, "Did your brothers and sisters at Kent and Jackson State die in vain? You are the capitalists of tomorrow. You are the politicians of tomorrow. You are the educators and the parents of tomorrow. Are you going to be agents of war, or are you going to be agents of peace?" In the crowd, 15 years old, Condoleezza Rice, I ask here, has she been an agent of peace or of war? And I get a resounding answer from, for example, those who have been fighting for civil rights and for environmental rights and their right to make a living in an environment that isn't totally polluted in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta, that she, as a director of the corporation Chevron, the oil corporation, where she sat on the board of directors for 10 years until she joined the Bush administration in 2001.
And has an oil tanker named after her, as we know.
They say she was an agent of increased segregation, of killings, of the devastation of their environment. Why? Because during that period, which was the period you remember where Chevron and Shell were involved in the killing of the Ogoni activists, Ken Saro-Wiwa and others, there were shareholder initiatives being brought before the board to say, we need to review as a corporation our relationship with the dictatorship of Sani Abacha. Condoleezza Rice sat on the Social Affairs Committee, Social Policy Committee of Chevron. There were only six people on it, and they rejected those shareholder initiatives out of hand. They wouldn't consider it. We can't choose which countries we do business with. We are ipso facto an agent of development and democracy. The women of Nigeria don't think she's brought them peace. And I wonder what the women of Iraq think right now.
I'm speaking with Laura Flanders, who is the author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, just published by Verso. Let's review her resume a bit. How did she get to this spot? She started out, she says, as a Democrat and became a Republican.
That's what she says. I mean, I found, of all the people in the book, I found her the most interesting in a sense and the saddest, because it's my reading of her history. And again, I mean, I'm just one reader. I'm suggesting there be more scrutiny, because what we've seen is the personal story overshadow the political record. It's great to hear somebody's personal story, but don't give us only her story in segregated Alabama. Don't give us only her as a paragon of civil rights accomplishments. She also has a role and a history as a member of the first Bush administration, as a dean at Stanford, and then at the Chevron Corporation and many other corporations around the country. This is where stereotypes do us in. Look at her, you don't see Oil Man. You don't see Dick Cheney. You don't see somebody of her ilk, of his ilk. She is of his ilk. But when she goes on television and says the war in Iraq is to liberate the people, not for oil, you're more likely to believe it, given our country's stereotype way of thinking, than when Cheney does. You see his face, up go the flags of Halliburton contracting oil. She, too, was involved in cutting up the deals in Caspian Sea to secure for Chevron and other U.S. corporations the right to drill in the most valuable oil fields. But that doesn't come along with her story. All we see is Birmingham, Alabama segregation. So I'm saying it's more complicated. I think what happened to her was that she was wooed by the right. She was given in her early teens, and she was she went to college very early, age 15, got a scholarship. She was given a year studying at Notre Dame. She then got an affirmative action scholarship to become a Hoover Institution fellow. There at the Hoover Institution, she found herself in the company of Cap Weinberger and Brent Scowcroft, and ultimately, of course, Schultz was there, George P. Schultz, who sort of went in and out of the Bechtel Corporation and successive U.S. governments.
Guy personifies the revolving door.
Exactly. He's so revolving, it's revolting. And I think they wooed her. I think they very effectively brought her into their community, under their wing. And she was a Sovietologist. She didn't really have a place in the sort of civil rights politics. That was never her thing. So really, she's not an expert in that area. She was a Sovietologist, and she worked in the first Bush administration. I urge people to read the book, because it gets complicated, but I think it's interesting. But if you look at Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, the book that we're discussing, I interviewed a lot of people who knew her in the first Bush administration, and they say that there was a real divide. And in that first administration, you had the Cheneys and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Pearl. You also had Powell and Condoleezza and Scowcroft and, well, George the First. There was a divide about how to respond to the crisis in the Soviet Union. And from the point of view of Cheney, Wolfowitz, and Pearl, Powell and Rice were on the wrong side of the divide. Their message and their advice to George the First was to retain relations with Gorbachev, to try to prop up the Soviet Union because it was the enemy we knew, kind of. Cheney and Rumsfeld wanted to get in at the beginning of the new republics. They wanted to hasten the decline of the Soviet Union and the breakup so as to be the first in on the ground in the creation of the new republics and to develop the economic relations and political relations that go with that. I think it's very interesting that she left the Bush administration kind of under a cloud. She'd been wrong, and they knew she was wrong in their terms. She had rejected the advances of Boris Yeltsin, and one of the great moments from her personal story of the Bush administration is that she barred the door when Yeltsin wanted to go and meet with President Bush, and he hadn't got a meeting with President Bush. He would have been very awkward if Bush had met with him and not Gorbachev at that time. This was before the end of Gorbachev's rule. She then comes into the Bush administration number two, along with Powell, I would say kind of tainted, kind of weakened, because the other people in the administration, the ones who have the upper hand because George II is not going to make the same mistakes his father did, they know what side she was on 10 years earlier. They know something that the rest of us don't know. And they know that everyone in the world is talking about how brilliant she is when they think she made a fundamental mistake, and they think she knows it too.
Much more in the book, which is Bush Women by Laura Flanders, who we're hearing from right now. And we're running low on time, so let's get to someone who is always reputed to be important but doesn't have a very high public profile, Karen Hughes. Who is she? Where'd she come from? Is she really gone now? Or
she is so far not gone. I mean, she is so far from gone. She was there, as people may remember, during the State of the Union. You saw her in the crowd. She helped write the State of the Union speech. She's not gone. She's just earning more as an independent contractor than she ever did inside the administration, and as a very effective campaigner on the campaign trail. Nobody did more campaigning in 2002. The cute thing about her is that she's somebody who has propped up and advanced an administration that is anti-civil rights, anti-affirmative action, anti-equal employment opportunity law, anti-union law, and we can talk about that if we had time. And yet, how did she get her first job? And people remember she was a newscaster in Texas, in Dallas. She worked on Channel 5, NBC affiliate. Well, she got that first job, I suggest, thanks to the National Organization for Women, who had sued NBC and the other networks in that year immediately preceding, and who had won in court, and that was the time of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission really taking U.S. corporations to court for failure to treat women and people of color fairly in the workplace. They sued, they won, they got a federal injunction, a mandate that these corporations had to practice affirmative action, had to abide by the federal mandates and advance women through the ranks, bring more women in to jobs. And that was the very time that Karen Hughes, then Karen Parfitt, whose father, interestingly enough, was the last governor general of Panama and brought down the U.S. flag in the Panama Canal Zone. She walks in for a job. She gets one. She takes it from there. But she got a lot of help. She had the government on her side. She had law on her side. She had the women's movement on her side. All institutions that she's now helped to shaft.
A lot of people who are beneficiaries of affirmative action don't want to continue it for the people behind them.
You betcha.
And we're just about out of time, but what about Lynn Cheney's lesbian novel?
Well, anybody that wants to know more about that should come out on Monday, March 8th, International Women's Day, at the New York Theater Workshop, 79 East 4th Street, right off 2nd Avenue between 2nd and Bowery on East 4th Street, where we will be presenting a sort of performance publication party for this book, and you will see for the first time ever adapted for the stage Lynn Cheney's 1981 novel called Sisters, that is really a celebration of lesbian romance, free love, has a fantastic scene of condom-protected sex in front of the fire between two people who are not married to each other, all in the American West of the late 19th century. There's a little bit more to Lynn Cheney than meets the eye. She sees people in very black and white terms today, but her history is a little bit more checkered than you might believe.
Well, that's a great tempting note to close on. Thanks for joining
us,
Laura Flanders. That's Bush
and it's
Women.
It's free.
Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, just published by Verso. And I meant to say earlier in the hour that Paul Sweezy, one of the founding editors of Monthly Review, died earlier this week at the age of 94. A very important figure in political economy in the United States, in American Marxism, and American independent publishing. I want to have more to say about him and his legacy next week, but I just wanted to note, I can't really say the passing of somebody who dies at the age of 94 with a long and long list of accomplishments behind him. That's not exactly tragic, but it is very sad to see Paul Sweezy die. So, closing on that funerary note, that's it from me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And let's go. Earlier in the week, I think it was Tuesday, was Lou Reed's 62nd birthday, which made me feel a little old. But also, I realized I'm still a decade younger than he is, so I don't have to feel too old yet. But let's go out with this little bit from Lou's raucous youth.
Now Rosie and the Crayon, they're busy waiting for her booster. She's just back from Carolina. She says she's bound to beat a sailor. Says you haven't got the time. You're busy sucking on my Now just like Sister Reese. I'm searching for my main line. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. Whip it on me, Jim. 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 Said I couldn't hit it sideways. Oh, do it. Now just like Sister Ray said. I said now Cecil's got his new beat. He cocks and shoots a bang between 3 and 4. At the sailor, he shoots him down there on the floor. Oh, you shouldn't do that. Don't you know you'll hit the carpet? Don't you know you'll mess the carpet? The time.